Very good. Thank you. Okay. So what I'll talk to you today about is distributed temperature sensing and how we can use some of that to look at soil heat flux as well as soil moisture. This work is a collaborative effort by quite a large group of people, including folks at my own university at Nevada, the group at Oregon State University, John Selker and his team, the Technical University of Delft, and the group at EPFL, Marc Parlange. And of course, Glendon, because pretty much everything I do with respect to water resources and soil physics and life has some imprint of Glendon, who I think has arrived. Is this correct? Is he here for his own session? Very good. Thank you, Glendon, for coming. I think everybody has a Glendon story who's ever worked with him, and so those usually revolve around chasing to the airport at very high speeds in a rental car that has to be returned because we're late for a flight. How many of you have had that experience? A few hands. I see a few. I want to share one story which is classic Glendon before I talk, which is I first arrived at Hanford as a young master's student, didn't know what the heck I was doing, and I found out within the first day that I was working for this fellow, Glendon Gee, who I seemed like an odd name, but an okay guy, I guess. And the first thing was somebody in the group looked at me and said, "You have a beard." I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, you have to shave that off." I said, "Why?" I said, "Well, you need to be fitted for a radiation mask." This was day one at Hanford. Okay, no one told me that. I thought it was a bit of a warm place to live, but I didn't think it was that bad. The next day, I get a note saying you're headed to Grand Junction, Colorado, because on your CV it says you know how to run a neutron probe and we have a little project there to work on. Still, I've not met Glendon at this point. I don't know who he is, but he's sending me all over the place. And by the fourth day, I was sitting on top of a uranium mill tailings pile measuring water content in the tailings pile. Again, still having never met Glendon, and an albino ground squirrel climbed out of the tailings pile about 20 feet from me, looked at me, and then started walking toward me. I kid you not. This is when I said, I need to find somebody else to work for at Battelle rather than Glendon. But fortunately, I overcame that minor trauma and have been working with Glendon ever since. And Glendon, thanks for all your hard work to keep me honest there. What's wrong with you? Okay, so let's start out. What is distributed temperature sensing? It's a moderately new technique to soils and water resources. It's we measure temperature using only the properties of a fiber optic cable, optical fiber. The optical fiber serves as our thermometer. There's no external sensing tools. We actually are looking at the optical properties of the glass itself to infer temperature. And a laser serves as our illumination source so that we can read the thermometer or energize the thermometer. We can measure temperature along an optical fiber with spatial resolution of between 25 centimeters to 2 meters. So that is every piece of the optical fiber we can estimate a temperature. We can do that on optical fibers for as long as 30 kilometers and in some cases these days even a bit longer. We can resolve those temperatures with moderate accuracy and reasonable precision every second to a minute. Typically 20 or 30 seconds is required for a reasonable measurement, and reasonable meaning resolutions of 0.03 to 0.1 degrees centigrade. So it's an interesting tool. It was originally developed for the oil and gas industry as well as for electric power transmission line monitoring. Oh, wrong way. Sorry. Okay, so how does it work? We send a short burst of laser light down an optical fiber, or in the terminology of the telecommunication, we launch a signal down an optical fiber. Most of that light transmits down the optical fiber and keeps going to the end of the fiber, which is how we communicate these days using telecommunications along optical fibers. A small amount of that energy of that light is actually scattered on its way as it's moving through the glass, and that scattered light is what gives us an indication of temperature. There's three kinds of scattering that goes on: Rayleigh scattering, which is an elastic scattering, Raman and Brillouin scattering. The backscatter intensity from the Raman frequencies turns out one of those backscatter intensities is to a large degree a function of the temperature of the object that it's scattered off of. Okay, so here's just a quick schematic. I'll use this. So we fire a pulse of laser light down an optical fiber. This is our incident light wavelength. We get a fair amount of that light back as scattered light coming straight back to us at the same frequency. Okay, so it's an elastic scattering process. Then we also get scattered light that comes back at longer wavelengths, lower frequencies, at the what we call the Stokes frequency in Raman scattering. Again, this is an inelastic scattering. This amplitude of the Stokes signal of the Raman frequency at the lower frequency is generally not much of a function of the temperature of the scatter. It is very slightly, but far less. And then at a higher frequency, shorter wavelength, we get our anti-Stokes frequencies coming back. And those are strongly a function of the temperature of the scatterer itself. So we shoot our laser light down at this wavelength, and then we look to see these two frequencies. And by ratioing the Stokes to the anti-Stokes frequency amplitudes, then from that we can estimate temperature. By the way, the shift between the Raman shift, both positive and the blue shift and the red shift, if you will, are predictable. They're a function of the glass and the wavelength of the laser itself. How do we know where it came from? Same way we do any kind of laser distancing or radar. We basically start a stopwatch when we launch a pulse of light down the fiber, and we wait to see those scattered light photons coming back, and we count how many seconds, or in this case, how many nanoseconds did it take. So typically, we fire a pulse of laser light for about 10 nanoseconds. In 10 nanoseconds, light flies or travels about 2 meters. So as soon as I pulse 10 nanoseconds of light, I open a detector for 10 nanoseconds, and I see any backscattered light that's traveled 2 meters, 1 meter out and 1 meter back. So I integrate over that 1 meter, I get the photons back. And I keep doing that until the lights reach the end of the optical fiber, however long that happens to be, and then I start the process over again. So I collect photons of Stokes and anti-Stokes frequencies for some time. That's my integration time, and when I get enough of them, then I can estimate temperature. Okay. So what about using this for soil moisture? This is some ideas that were kicked around recently. So soil moisture, for all of us here and I think in a much larger community, it's critical for our terrestrial energy budgets these days, weather forecasting. Everything we do to some degree relies upon what is the state of soil moisture in the environment. And we're just starting to get sensors that now integrate or measure at scales that are appropriate or at the same scales or at least reasonably similar scales for atmospheric modeling, for climate modeling, for predictive purposes beyond the point sensor. Okay, and two that I threw out here, the COSMOS sensor from the University of Arizona, Ty's group, and the SMAP mission, which is the Soil Moisture Active Passive radar mission that's going to be launched by NASA next year. So we can finally start looking at the field scale. Now, Steele Dunn et al. In 2010 looked at the idea of using fiber optic temperature sensing as a way to measure both diurnal heat exchange from the soil and also infer soil moisture. Saidi, the next year, developed a heated fiber cable in which the optical fiber, we put a pulse of electricity through the strength elements of an optical fiber, the conductive elements, heat the fiber up and watch it cool down as it's buried in the soil. And from this we can infer soil moisture or thermal conductivity and infer soil moisture from that. So it's essentially a long, long series of heat dissipation probes. So I'm going to talk to you today about this idea of using just the diurnal temperature fluctuations as a way to infer soil moisture, thermal properties of soil. One of the things that Steele Dunn et al. Noticed in their preliminary work was that the spacing, the distance between temperature spacings, temperature sensors in the vertical, that measurement was critical. Knowing that depth is critical, and it comes right out of the conductive heat equation. That was very important, as well as what was the boundary condition for temperature. So to invert our conductive heat transport equation to estimate the thermal diffusivity, which is a function of moisture content, and from that perhaps infer the moisture content of the soil. Okay. So what did we do? We went out with a group from Delft and others, and we said, well, we can put one optical fiber in the ground, but let's put 3. And so what you see here is a system to install 3 optical fibers in a field. This happens to be in Oklahoma at one of the NASA calibration validation sites. We're installing 3 optical fibers into the soil. So those are 3 fibers. They go down, they go into a plow system, which is a little bit hard to see, right down there. And that plow then inserts the optical fibers into the soil on a slant, on an angle. So we try not to disturb the soil too much, although obviously we are disturbing the soil. We have a little cutter out ahead. We all got to play agricultural engineers building this. It was quite a lot of fun, using a welder and breaking things. Anyway, the fiber is then inserted into the soil. You can see the yellow one is right on the top. Is right at or near the soil surface, and the other two are installed, I think at this site, is 5 and 10 centimeters below the surface. The yellow cable is slightly different. It's the same optical fiber, it's just a bit stronger because this site has cows walking around, and so we wanted the uppermost fiber to be fairly strong and could withstand cows. By the way, never show a video like this to your university safety officer. I have worse videos that I showed once, and I got in trouble. So, yeah. Okay. So this is what the installation looks like. This is a site in Nevada that we're working on, looking at alternative crop designs for low water use. And we've just dug away the trench, so you can see here's the 3 cables that have been installed in the soil. Okay, the top at the surface, 5 and 10 centimeters in this case. So again, we've just dug it away. This is what it looked like after that over there is what it looks like once it starts growing back in. And here you can see we keep that spacing really quite systematic and constant because the plow system inserts the cables at specific spacing. So what I'm going to show you then are some temperature data from our field plot, which is in is right down here. And you can see this kind of cool patchwork, which it's a series of randomized plots that are using different different crops as well as different watering regimes to look at the impacts of taking ag land out of production, out of irrigated production, and trying to stabilize it as well as generate some crop revenue. If we blow it up, so even this is what the site looks like. These are about 10 meters on a square, if I recall, 8 meters on a square, each one planted differently, randomized. The irrigation gradient goes from low irrigation up at this end of the field to high to 100% PET down at this end. And we've installed the optical fiber with that plow system. Here we took a hard right turn, I guess that is, and passed through all these plots. Okay, and our instruments is sitting here. So I'm just going to show you some data right from here from just one of the plots, the temperature versus time. This is what it looks like. Nothing too surprising here. This is temperature at 5, 10, and 15 centimeter depths in the soil profile. Irrigation was here. This was all spray irrigated. And then this is in September, and you can see these are then the time evolution of temperature. This is the near the surface, a little bit down at 10 centimeters, and then at 15 centimeters. So pretty reasonable, pretty normal what you'd expect to see, that our thermal pulse is moderated as we move down. There's some phase lag, and then there's some amplitude decay as the heat moves down. So from this, our hope was we had excellent control on spacing, that we could invert our thermal heat conduction equation and estimate the thermal diffusivity, and from there estimate the moisture content. And again, we can now do this not just at one place in the profile, but we can do it across that entire roughly 500 meters of optical fibers setup that we have at that field site. So this is just some of the thermal properties from this site. This is the we have a measurement at saturation for the thermal conductivity. It's a fairly low quartz soil, and you can see that our thermal conductivity varies slightly over from saturated down to about 10% water content, and then really drops off. It's a fairly sandy soil, coarse textured soil. And our thermal diffusivity calculated for this site does the classic thing in which we have a non-monotonic behavior of thermal diffusivity, climbs up to a maximum at around 10 or 15% water content, and then drops off precipitously. As we're going to see later, unfortunately, we're working, our soil moisture regime, because this is an irrigated agriculture site, we're working in this range here where we see relatively small influence of moisture content on the thermal diffusivity, which we knew was going to happen. So this was not too surprising to us. We were hoping we'd be in a little better straits. So again, let's take a look. Now I'm going to take these data that I just showed you. I'm going to invert the thermal conduction equation, and I'm going to estimate the thermal diffusivity needed to match my blue, the center line, the 10-centimeter depth, using as boundary conditions the upper 5-centimeter depth, and as a lower boundary condition, the 15-centimeter depth. So a really well-constrained problem. I have only 10 centimeters of soil I have to simulate, and I'm going to try to do that over time. And so here's what we see for estimated diffusivities. Depending upon my window over which I estimate my thermal diffusivity to match the data, if I use a two-hour resolution or two-hour window, my thermal diffusivity that best fits the data ranges between 0.3 and about, and a really big number. Okay, bad. If I try to fit it over 12 hours, it looks a little better. And if I try to integrate, use 24-hour data, well, at least it looks smooth, but it's unchanging with time, which is a bit sad because we were hoping to see a change in diffusivity with time. And in fact, we were hoping to see an increase in thermal diffusivity as we ramped up toward the wet end. Okay, all right, so let's move quickly. And here's the real reason is my observed is this kind of funny-looking green line. And the three other lines are the predicted temperatures at 10-centimeter depth using 2, 12, or 24-hour. And you can see I fit it quite well no matter what thermal diffusivity I use. So it's a poorly constrained problem. The issues are we're trying to estimate a second derivative from 3 points. That's pretty difficult. We've got some higher frequency components as well as lower frequency components in the temperature. You saw the temperature slowly raised with time. And again, we're in this region of low sensitivity to moisture content and thermal diffusivity. So next step, well, let's do something with this. It's beautiful data. We can estimate the soil heat flux because we can look at the spatial variability of soil heat flux across this entire field. I have 500 measurements of temperature every minute. And we're doing some filtering as well using some methods that were developed for hyperreic exchange. And then the real thing is to add heat to the cable and use the same cable as an active sensor, as a heat dissipation probe. And I just want to show you, here's some heat flux from those same data. The heat flux at in between the top and the middle probe is the red line, and the blue line is the heat flux between the middle and lower probe. So we can actually start to back out soil heat flux at pretty high spatial vertical resolution, as well as, again, every meter we can give you an estimate of soil heat flux, assuming we can get the thermal diffusivity well, or thermal conductivity. Okay, within the last 2 minutes here, all I have, whoops, that's clever. One of the things we do, my group and OSU were sponsored by the National Science Foundation to get these instruments out into the field to users. So we have an NSF user instrument facility where we can provide to researchers at a very low cost, we don't make any money, trust me, these instruments, these fiber optic sensing instruments, as well as training and give you some advice on how they can be used in a variety of environmental settings. A lot of our focus to date has been on groundwater surface water exchange, but there's lots of opportunities in soils. The plow that I showed you, the real safe looking plow system, if you wear a hard hat, I'll loan it to you for free, you can have it. Okay, and so again, I just wanted to kind of make that known to the community here. It's well known in the hydrologic community, but we'd be happy to talk to folks to help you out, get you started on this. We also have some other instruments, some acoustic, distributed acoustic sensing that we're playing some games with. So it's a time of sensor revolution in our fields, and Glendon, I think, was one of those who really led this. And so I thought it was quite fitting that we continue that tradition as all of us. On instrumentation. So with that, I just want to thank Glendon personally. I see him in the back of the room. Glendon, I think all of us in our field, in our work, hope that we can make an impact to our colleagues around us and help them out. And from my personal perspective, if you weren't around, I would be, well, your presence is in all of my work, and I thank you. Thank you.